KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, prices still rising, and the president of the Chicago Fed explains what he thinks fiscal policy can and cannot do for consumers. Then elections in Germany, where a far-right party is on the rise, and Costanza Zellenmuller of the Brookings Institution says...
It is pro-Russian, pro-Chinese, it is anti-NATO, anti-supporting Ukraine, and also, frankly, it has always been anti-American.
And later, more Israeli hostages released. In sports, the four nations face off. And Alison Epstein's new novel takes one of fiction's great scoundrels and makes him human. Fagin the Thief. First, our newscast. It's Saturday, February 22nd, 2025.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Hamas released six Israeli hostages today. In exchange, Israel released more than 600 Palestinians held in Israeli jails. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports.
This is the largest release of Palestinian prisoners and detainees at one time during this ceasefire. Among them are prisoners serving life sentences for deadly attacks on Israelis, but also many who have been held in administrative detention without charge or sentences, including women and minors. More than 400 of them are Palestinians who had been detained in Gaza during the war, and they're going to be released back to Gaza. Others are being deported to Egypt.
NPR's Kat Lonsdorf. The Trump administration is refusing to sign on to a UN General Assembly resolution to mark the third anniversary of Russia's invasion. Instead, it's proposing its own text, which does not criticize Russia at all. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports a vote on the resolution is set for Monday.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio calls it a simple, historic resolution to support a path to peace. He says the UN should affirm that this conflict is awful and that the UN can help end it. Ukraine and the Europeans had proposed a much longer text that reminds the world that Russia is violating the UN Charter by invading its neighbor. It calls on Russia to withdraw and return all civilians, including children, who were forcibly deported to Russia. The U.S. text simply acknowledges tragic losses, with no language saying Russia started the war, and calls for a quick end to the conflict. Russia's ambassador to the U.N. called it a good move by the Trump administration to offer a rival text. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
The Defense Department announced it's firing 5,400 probationary workers next week. Yesterday, President Trump fired Charles Q. Brown, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the second black officer to hold that position. The Associated Press has sued the Trump administration for barring it from major presidential events over its refusal to refer to the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America. As NPR's David Folkenflik reports, the AP says its ban represents an unconstitutional government retaliation against speech.
Trump signed an order making the name change on his first day, but it doesn't carry any weight outside the U.S. The AP serves audiences and news outlets across the globe. It recommends its journalists and clients call the body of water the Gulf of Mexico, but acknowledge Trump's preferred name. The AP's reporters have been barred from formal events and exchanges with Trump at the White House and his Florida state Mar-a-Lago and on Air Force One. Trump said earlier this week he would keep the ban unless the AP relented. In response to the lawsuit, White House spokesperson Steve Chung accused the AP's reporters of being ideologues and said its leaders had rotted peanut-sized brains. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
This is NPR News. Investigators in Germany say the suspect in a stabbing yesterday is a refugee from Syria who wanted to kill Jews. The stabbing took place at Berlin's Holocaust Memorial and badly injured a tourist from Spain. There have been several attacks in recent weeks in which the suspects were from migrant backgrounds. This has made migration a major issue in Germany's national election, which takes place tomorrow. Conservatives opposed to President Trump and his policies are gathering in Washington this weekend. As NPR's Sarah McCammon reports, the principal's first summit overlaps with the larger, mostly pro-Trump gathering known as CPAC.
Principles First bills itself as an organization for principled conservatives. Founder Heath Mayo says conservatives and centrists who oppose Trump are regrouping after the 2024 election and discussing how to move forward.
I don't think we're under any illusions that the Republican Party is changing anytime soon. And so what we really want to do is engage in the conversation about where the country is going next.
Speakers at this year's summit include billionaire Mark Cuban, former United States Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, and former Trump National Security Advisor John Bolton. Sarah McCammon, NPR News, Washington.
A federal judge has agreed to decide if the death penalty using nitrogen gas is cruel and unusual punishment. In 2022, U.S. District Judge Shelley Dick had dismissed a lawsuit challenging that method in Louisiana, since no executions had been planned. Now there are two executions scheduled to take place next month. The judge said the new method must be reviewed. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
Weekend edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon, and thank you for being with us. New data says that consumer sentiment is down and prices are to blame. That's from University of Michigan survey and a CNN poll. It is a sharp reversal from the post-election hopes that Donald Trump would bring household costs down. Austin Goolsbee is president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. He chaired President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors and joins us now from Chicago. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Scott. Great to talk to you again.
It is 30 days into the Trump administration. Is it a little too early to expect a turnaround?
When the Fed is fighting inflation, it's not actually trying to get the price level back to what it was 5 years ago. It's trying to get the inflation rate down to 2%. And that can drive my mom crazy. You know, well, what do you mean you're not trying to get the prices back down? But that's because the level of prices kind of grows over time. And the goal is that income would grow faster than the prices are growing. That's what you want for real incomes to be increasing. How long it's going to take for inflation to truly get back down to the level that it was at before COVID. We're still fighting inflation, and we're going to keep fighting inflation, but it's going to take longer than 30 days.
What effect does consumer sentiment have on the economy?
It historically has been a pretty good indicator of how people would choose to spend in the near future, and it's why people paid a lot of attention to it. In recent years, it's become a little bit less good as a predictor of behavior. So you've had people saying, the economy stinks, I'm upset, but they would still go out and spend money when they got a paycheck. So consumer sentiment indicates something, but it's no longer the specific economic indicator that it was in the past, I'd say.
Are you suggesting that consumers would most wisely adjust to higher prices as long as their earnings go up too?
I don't know about the wisdom. The reality has been that over long periods of time, you know, you'll remember, I had a grandpa who would refuse to go take us to the movies. And his thing was, when I was a kid, the movies cost a nickel. I'm not going to go to the movies that it cost $15. That idea that the price level is thought of some way separate from what incomes are, That's a different way to look at it than mostly how the economists are looking at it. And I absolutely understand why people are as upset about inflation as they have been. That said, there are certain public prices that have an outsized impact on consumer confidence, like the price of gas, the price of groceries, which the Fed mostly doesn't look at energy and food prices. It tends to concentrate on what they call core inflation, because energy and food prices are so variable and up and down that they don't give you as good an indicator of what's the underlying trend going on there.
But I mean, that of course introduces the question, is the Fed measuring results in a way that doesn't affect individual consumers and congratulating itself for having an effect when individual consumers are saying, wait, I can't afford groceries?
That's a fair criticism. In a way, the Fed is bound by the Federal Reserve Act and the law. What is it supposed to look at when it's setting monetary policy? And the law says what the Fed is supposed to do is stabilize the prices and maximize employment. There's still a substantial amount of work to do, even on the limited criteria of getting the inflation rate back to 2%. We have not yet succeeded in doing that.
I have to ask you a question of the moment, because you're now part of a largely independent part of the government, the Federal Reserve, which dates back to 1913. Trump administration is dismantling many other independent agencies. Do you think the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago or other feds are at risk the way the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is?
I don't know much about the legal side of those things. I've been in the Fed for a little over 2 years. Before I ever got to the Fed, I was an economist, and it's virtual unanimity about the importance of central bank independence in setting monetary policy, that it be separate as much as possible from sitting administrations. And the reason economists are unanimous about that is because if you look around the world at countries where that's not true, the inflation rate is higher, the growth is slower, job market performance is worse. And so I think Fed independence is really quite important.
Austin Goolsbee, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott. It was a real treat.
Germany votes tomorrow at a critical time for Europe, with concern over Russian aggression. And in Germany, worry over economic stagnation, anger over immigration, and a surge in support for the far-right Alternative for Germany Party, or AfD. That party has downplayed the horrors of Germany's history under Nazi rule, and Vice President J.D. Vance has met with the AfD's leader. Constance Seltzenmuller joins us now. She's director of the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure and an honor.
As you see it, what's at stake for Germany with this vote?
I think this is the most consequential election I have ever voted in. And it's consequential because this is about Germany's ability to form a stable government, and it is about Germany's ability to be a good partner in NATO and the European Union, a good neighbor, and to be a functioning part of the European security order. So that's not exactly a small charge.
And what about the stakes for Europe as you see them?
Well, you know, I'm not sure whether they were ever the good old days, but people used to call for Franco-German leadership of Europe, which has become a bit of a tired cliche. We're now 27 members of the European Union and 32 members of NATO, and I think nobody wants a Franco-German motor. But the truth is, with an economy as powerful as Germany's, and with the enormous power and size differences between Germany and most of its neighbors, it does get noticed when we're not pulling our weight. And so what this is about is preserving our ability to pull our weight and to play a responsible role given our power.
Vice President Vance gave a speech at the Munich Security Conference, which I think it's fair to say caused a lot of consternation.
Indeed.
Let me quote. He told European leaders, "If you're running in fear of your own voters, there is nothing America can do for you." What's been the effect of those remarks and Mr. Vance's meeting with the AFD leader?
Yeah, I think perhaps we should start with an explanation of what the AFD is, shouldn't we? Because, yes, the consternation is very real. I don't think any pronouncement by an American official in my lifetime has sent such shockwaves throughout the country. So the AFD is one of Europe's most overtly right-wing extremist parties. It is pro-Russian, pro-Chinese, it is anti-NATO, anti-supporting Ukraine, and also, frankly, it has always been anti-American, right? It's now pretending it isn't, but that's just not true. And, you know, at least as importantly for the ordinary German, it wants to change the nature of the German constitutional order, which I would like to remind American listeners, America helped us bring about in after World War II.
What about Mr. Vance's central point, which seems to be Europe, you're on your own?
I think what J.D. Vance, the vice president, is perfectly right, is to say to Europeans, listen, America has other preoccupations around the world, and it is past time for you to play a greater role, pull a greater weight in the transatlantic alliance. And I think given the Russian behavior, not just in Ukraine, where Russia every day bombards Ukrainian cities, where every day people are killed on the front line and under these bombardments, but also Russian disinformation and sabotage in Europe and in my own country, Germany, at levels that we haven't seen since the Cold War, and maybe not even then, right? Europeans and my country are scrambling to increase their defense spending and up their defense industry. And I think that the vice president's speech, and even more the president's remarks about Russia and, if you will, upgrading Russia as a partner to this administration and downgrading Ukraine, insulting its elected president, that has really, I think, made Europeans realize that they might indeed be on their own.
And what are the implications for Ukraine with this vote?
I think if current polling is an accurate predictor of the election outcome, you'll have a conservative chancellor in coalition with the Social Democrats and possibly also the Greens. All three of those parties agree on supporting Ukraine, on loosening government spending in what is very clearly a national emergency, on stopping Russian attempts at intimidating Germany and Europe. They agree on playing a greater role in NATO, playing a greater role in the European Union, and I think they would all hope to have a good relationship with the Trump administration.
Constanze Stelzenmüller of the Brookings Institution, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
And you're listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Hamas released 6 Israeli hostages today. In exchange, Israel freed more than 600 Palestinian prisoners and detainees. Monday marks the 3rd anniversary of Russia's large-scale invasion of Ukraine. The UN General Assembly is to vote on a resolution to mark the day. The U.S. is offering a version that acknowledges tragic losses but does not mention that Russia started the war. And it took a jury less than 2 hours yesterday to convict a man of the attempted murder of novelist Salman Rushdie. Rushdie was stabbed multiple times while he was giving a lecture in New York in 2022. The attack left him blind in one eye. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Hamas released 6 more Israeli hostages from Gaza today as part of a ceasefire deal with Israel that has held for more than a month. In exchange, Israel is expected to release more than 600 Palestinian prisoners and detainees held in Israeli jails. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf is in Tel Aviv. Kat, thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, good morning.
What can you tell us about the hostages released today?
So the hostages released today are 4 men who had been captured in the October 7th, 2023 Hamas-led attack on southern Israel and held captive throughout the war. And then also 2 hostages that have been held in Gaza for around a decade. One is an Ethiopian Israeli man and the other is a Bedouin Arab citizen of Israel. Both of them had been taken captive after they had crossed into Gaza on their own years ago in separate incidents.
And what were today's releases like?
So in Gaza, it was a bit more complicated than other releases in the past. The 6 were released in 3 different locations throughout the Gaza Strip. But generally, the scene was similar to others that we've seen in this past month. The hostages were brought on a stage by a masked Hamas gunman with a huge crowd of Palestinian onlookers before being released to the International Committee of the Red Cross and then driven to meet Israeli forces.
In exchange for these hostages and the 4 bodies returned earlier this week, Israel has agreed to release more than 600 Palestinians from Israeli jails. Yeah. What details do you have about that?
So this is the largest release of Palestinian prisoners and detainees at one time during this ceasefire. Among them are prisoners serving life sentences for deadly attacks on Israelis, but also many who have been held in administrative detention without charge or sentences, including women and minors. More than 400 of them are Palestinians who had been detained in Gaza during the war, and they're going to be released back to Gaza. Others are being deported to Egypt.
Kat, there was a mix-up with one of the bodies Hamas released earlier this week. It was supposed to be that of an Israeli mother, returned with the bodies of her 2 young sons who were slain, but it wasn't. What's the latest?
Yeah, so this was the body of Shiri Bibas, who had been captured with her husband and 2 young sons on October 7th, 2023. And together, the family had become a symbol in Israel of the hostage struggle. Hamas says Shiri and her 2 children were killed in an Israeli airstrike early in the war. Hamas supposedly released their bodies on Thursday, like you said, but when they were taken to a forensic lab here in Israel, it was found that the woman's body was not Shiri. It was an unidentified woman. Hamas then gave a different body back to Israel late last night. That body was then positively identified as Shiri. The forensic examiner here in Israel found that all 3, Shiri and her 2 young sons, had been, quote, murdered, but did not provide further details or evidence as to how.
This is the last scheduled release of hostages who are alive from Gaza in the first phase of the agreement. What's next?
So there are 4 more bodies set to be released next week in this first phase, but there are still dozens of hostages in Gaza. Talks for the next phase of the deal, they were supposed to start weeks ago, and they haven't started yet. Hamas has said it's ready to, quote, engage immediately in negotiations, but the situation here in Israel is really complicated. Several far-right members in Israel's government want the war to resume. Meanwhile, most of the Israeli public want the ceasefire to continue, and the rest of the hostages to be released. Here's 43-year-old Liat Ellert. She talked to NPR producer Itay Stern this morning in a crowd of people gathered in Tel Aviv in support of the hostages.
If you're walking around here and seeing all the people here, the people of Israel are voting with their hands, feet, whatever they can do, and doing everything they can in their power to bring those hostages back home.
You know, many of the Israelis we talked to today had a similar sentiment. They want this war to be over, and they want the rest of the hostages released.
And here's Kat Lonsdorf in Tel Aviv. Thanks so much, Kat.
Thank you.
Imagine getting fired, then unfired, and fired again. That's what some people caught up in the Trump administration's purge of federal workers have gone through, and now some are speaking out. NPR's Andrea Hsu brings us one of their stories.
Mike Makins and his family live far from Washington, D.C.
We live in Anchorage, Alaska. I came up here in 2015 when I was stationed up here in the Army at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson.
After 5 years in the Army, he worked in security on Alaska's North Slope, and then took a job in emergency management with the state. It was work that made him feel like he could really make a difference.
You know, Alaska has every possible disaster threat you could think of, from volcanoes to hurricane to tsunami, earthquake, fire, flood.
Through his work for the state, he got to know the folks at FEMA and the Small Business Administration, the federal agency that helps businesses and homeowners recover from disasters. 6 months ago, an opportunity opened up to join the SBA as recovery coordinator for Alaska and much of the Pacific Northwest. It was a brand new position to provide ongoing help once the initial shock of a disaster is over.
All right, we still have these people in shelters, or we still have this kind of significant problem in the community that there's no apparent resource to help them.
Makins was the guy people could call to cut through the bureaucracy.
The phone a friend for the region.
His deep knowledge of Alaska's wild weather and terrain and its diverse population made him a good fit for the job. Laura Makins, Mike's wife, says it was like he had finally arrived.
You know, we had talked like, this is going to be your career, like you're going to retire from this job. And that was really exciting.
And then 2 weeks ago came the email, the first one.
February 7th, late afternoon, Alaska time.
The subject line, termination of probationary period. The letter attached said, you have failed to demonstrate fitness for continued federal employment. It gave him a termination date of February 21st. When Laura came home that afternoon, she could tell something was wrong.
And that's when he dropped the bomb, I got fired, and I just couldn't even believe it.
It was a terrible weekend. Makins was angry. He couldn't sleep.
You turn off the lights and try to go to sleep, and you're just left alone with your thoughts.
He tried to keep it together for their kids, a three-year-old and an infant. Then Monday came another surprise. A colleague told him something was up. Someone had burst into a meeting to say Friday's termination letters may have been a mistake.
Sure enough, an hour or two later, we got that email that said it was sent in error, and as such, it is not currently in effect. Well, what does that mean?
He wasn't too reassured, and good thing, because the next day, he got not one, but two emails telling him, actually, you are fired, effective close of business that day.
And to make it worse, there's absolutely no follow-up. That is literally the last official correspondence regarding my employment status that I received from the SBA.
The agency hasn't sent the documents he needs to apply for unemployment. They haven't told him anything about his health insurance.
The only place I've gotten any help is online, on frickin' Reddit.
Which is where so many federal workers have turned for answers since the chaos of this administration began. Now, Laura is a cancer survivor. She needs costly medications. The kids need routine care.
Just the disregard for, the impact that this has on not only the employee, but his whole family is astounding.
Ironically, Mike Makin's performance evaluation came in the week he got fired. It was outstanding. Now he feels betrayed by a government he's chosen to serve twice, all to make the country better.
There's no one that works in the federal government that will tell you that there doesn't need to be changes to the way the bureaucracy works, to maybe the way we spend money. I think those are very fair criticisms of the government. I am trying to be part of the solution.
For now, Makins has appealed his termination.
I really want to go back to my job. I don't think I am going to be able to go back to my job.
Regardless what happens, his trust in the government is shattered. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
And now it's time for sports. Four nations, one champion, what a week in hockey. And a rising basketball superstar is sidelined. Howard Brad of Better Luck Media joins us. Howard, thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Scott. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. NHL did away with the All-Star game this year and instead came up with the Four Nations Face-Off, U.S., Canada, Sweden, and Finland. Boy, it was electric. Canada defeated the U.S. in overtime, 3-2, claimed the title. Once they stopped fighting and were able to play hockey, was this a great idea?
It was a terrific idea. It was a great idea. It was really injected some life into the tournament. People were excited about it, and hockey got a boost. Obviously, if you are an owner of one of the NHL teams and during this exhibition, one of your star players got hurt, such as Matthew Tkachuk of the Florida Panthers, who happened to be the Stanley defending champions, and also Charlie McAvoy of the Boston Bruins, you don't love this tournament that much. But in terms of what they produced on the ice, people were excited. It was a great, great tournament. And what an alternative from an All-Star game that had gotten stale.
Well, and what does that say about the current state of All-Star games? Because, you know, the NFL Pro Bowl isn't even a game anymore. The NBA All-Star game isn't very competitive. American and National League teams play each other all the time now. They don't need an All-Star game. Is the NHL onto something here?
I think they are, because the sport has changed. All sports have changed so much. In the old days, there were multiple reasons to play in these in the All-Star game. One, it was an honor. It was an absolute honor to be recognized as one of the best players in your sport. The players took that seriously. The other reason was money. Most players had an incentive. If you made the All-Star game, you made extra money, and money was tight back then. And you know, even when guys were making like real money to the rest of us, it wasn't a huge amount, so you needed those incentives. And today, when you're making $30, $40, $50 million, you know, playing in the tournament, some of the guys would rather have the rest. And I think that you're seeing it across all the sports. You look at the basketball All-Star game and the NBA, people just laugh at it. It's not competitive at all. They're not even trying. And I think technology had a lot to do with it in baseball. Like when I was growing up in Boston as a kid, it was a one-team market, so you never got to see the National League. Now you have interleague every single day. So the question has really been, has sort of time and technology and progress taken away the importance of the All-Star game? What people really, really want is they want to see you trying and competing. And so the sports have really tried to figure out, okay, how do we get these guys come out, you know, to get them come out and to compete and to give the fans an actual battle? And I think Four Nations was a great way to do it, to really put some stakes into it. And it was fantastic. Of course, three fights in the first 9 seconds between
yes.
USA and Canada makes us really look forward to the Olympics as well.
Oh, gosh. Victor Wembanyama, the great French superstar of the San Antonio Spurs, is out for the rest of the season. Doctors discovered a blood clot in his right shoulder. It's a little scary, isn't it?
Yeah, very scary, especially because when he's 21 years old and he is a superstar, but you get a blood clot, that those things are very serious. It is, whether you want to call it or not, it is life-threatening. They travel throughout your bloodstream. They can get into your heart, your brain, wherever. And so it's a really, really scary moment for somebody who, in his second year, is 24 points, 11 rebounds, blocks. He's the future face of the franchise, of the sport. But this is not something that you... you want to take lightly. So serious move, but a smart move by the San Antonio Spurs.
And finally, this just in, the New York Yankees say, okay, we'll groom beards. We'll allow them.
For the first time in 50 years. Yankee tradition since George Steinbrenner brought the team in 1973, no facial hair. Then starting in 1975...
Mickey Mantle and Roger Maris didn't have beards.
Exactly. Then it was no facial hair below the lip, and now they have finally, 50 years later, relented. I called a Yankee friend of mine, and I said, what's next? Names on the back of the jerseys? Horrors. Tradition.
Well, Howard Bryant of Meadowlark Media, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station.
And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. After enormously destructive wildfires hit Los Angeles, a new exhibit at UCLA's Fowler Museum asked visitors to see fire in a different way. Andrea Gutierrez recently visited the exhibit.
I'm drawn to the room across the gallery that's giving off an orange glow. In it, lights shine through hundreds of California poppies hanging from the ceiling. Not real poppies, paper, each on their own string. Their shadows flicker on the walls in a way that feels familiar, like the way the sky looks during a wildfire.
You know, that was kind of the intent behind it, to cast those shadows and to evoke kind of that eerie feeling of fire.
This is Leah Matafrawa, an artist and member of the Northern Chumash tribe. She says that poppies and fire are a natural fit.
After a burn, they're one of the first flowers to reappear. And if you drive by burn spars, then you start seeing these poppies emerge.
Matafrawa's materials are all plant-based. And when the exhibition ends, she plans to burn it all. The ashes she'll put in her garden to grow materials for future installations.
So these poppies will continue in other ways.
The poppies are part of an exhibition called Fire Kinship, Southern California Native Ecology and Art. It challenges visitors to rethink their own relationships with fire.
And really looking at indigenous fire stewardship practices, which were already existing.
This is Daisy Ocampo-Diaz, one of the exhibition's curators. She's of the Kashkan tribe. This show has been in the works since well before the Eaton and Palisades fires became some of the most destructive in California history. And it coincides with an era in which tribes throughout the state have been steadily revitalizing their own fire stewardship practices, which for millennia helped to maintain a landscape where fire is endemic.
The timing is obviously very pertinent.
At the heart of the exhibit is the practice of cultural burning and how it's much more than just a way of preventing wildfire.
This red is our natural red or brown. And if the taller ones, you'll probably see more.
This moment comes early in the exhibition. Lorene Sisquak, an elder on the Kaweah Reservation, shows youth how to gather juncus, a type of grass used in basket weaving. The really good stuff is at the bottom of the plant, so weavers need to pull on it regularly.
And go as close as you can, but watch your eyes from getting poked, and then pull.
Historically, each community, each village had patches of the material they needed, and every 3 to 5 years is usually around that ideal time. You burned that patch because you saw it wasn't in great shape.
Any overgrowth can suffocate an entire patch.
So you need fire to pretty much burn all the junkus grass without killing its roots.
Sometimes the cultural part gets lost in the fire part.
This is Danny Manning at the Tsaida Maidu in Northern California. He's a fire practitioner. Tribes invite him to help plan their cultural burns. He says the actual burn might take only a day or two.
But the other 98% is the cultural part, is actually taking care of the land and gathering the pieces you need for your basketry or your medicine.
Last year, that patch of juncus on the Kaweah Reservation was finally burned for the first time in a very long time.
It had been 200 years.
Ocampo-Diaz says that burn did exactly what it was supposed to. When she checked on it recently, it had new sprouts.
That's what it needed. Healthy, strong grass.
It's that healthy growth that just might keep the next fire at bay. For NPR News, I'm Andrea Gutierrez in Los Angeles.
This is NPR News.
Malcolm X is often portrayed as an angry black man. His daughter says this is wrong.
Many people have been miseducated about who my father was, but my father just insisted his country live up to liberty and justice for all of its citizens.
Ilyasa Shabazz on the 60th anniversary of her father's death. Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. President Trump has fired the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Air Force General Charles Q. Brown was the second black officer in that job. Trump is also replacing Lisa Franchetti as Chief of Naval Operations. She was the second woman to be promoted to four-star admiral. Disaster experts say job cuts at FEMA this week could hamper the agency's ability to respond to floods, hurricanes, and wildfires. And Stellantis is recalling more than 27,000 Maserati vehicles because the rearview camera doesn't display. The recall notice applies to certain vehicles made between 2022 and 2025. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/IULab. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. And from ECMC Foundation, at ecmcfoundation.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. A Mississippi judge ordered the removal of an editorial from a small-town newspaper that was critical of city officials in the town of Clarksdale. That action has sparked complaints from press freedom advocates who say that it is clearly unconstitutional. Michael McEwen from Mississippi Public Broadcasting reports.
If you ask Wyatt Emmerich, owner of the Clarksdale Press Register, the city's lawsuit against his paper is the result of a contentious relationship that started 4 years ago.
With reporting that the mayor and the city council gave themselves shockingly big raises. We reported on it and the citizens got outraged and the mayor didn't really see why we needed to report on that. And then it's just gone on since then.
Now, a judge has issued a temporary restraining order, requiring him to take down the editorial. It questions why city officials didn't give notice to the media about a meeting on a proposed tax increase. They taped a hard copy piece of paper on a bulletin board at City Hall, but didn't send notice to the paper. The city says that was just a mistake.
We never got a chance to present our side of the case at all, never even served process. The judge just listened to their side and ruled against us.
Hinds County Judge Crystal Wise Martin called the editorial defamation of public officials. The editorial at one point asked the question, quote, have commissioners or the mayor gotten kickback from the community? The city attorney would not go on tape, but accused the paper of lying and told us, quote, they said we're getting kickbacks in the editorial. But the paper says the phrase was merely used as a synonym for pushback.
It should take 5 minutes of legal research to figure out that this ruling was unconstitutional.
That's attorney Seth Stern with the Freedom of the Press Foundation.
Either the judge did not put in that 5 minutes of legal research and entered this ruling out of ignorance, or they did put in that 5 minutes of legal research, knew that their ruling was wrong, but didn't care.
Judge Wise Martin did not respond to a request for comment on the ruling. She set a hearing for later this month. Emmerich's paper has been around since 1865 and serves a community of about 14,000. He says this lawsuit shows that what they write matters.
In a way, I'm encouraged that we're being read and we're having an impact. And the city of Clarksdale feels like we are a watchdog. They just don't want to be watched.
He's also vowed to file a federal lawsuit over First Amendment violations should the judge ultimately not rule in the paper's favor. For NPR News, I'm Michael McEwen in Jackson, Mississippi.
President Trump picked up significant support in 2024 from Arab and Muslim voters in Michigan. NPR checks back with some of those voters in Dearborn and now finds a range of opinions. That's later today on All Things Considered. You can listen by telling your smart speaker to play your local station by name. A large part of any pastor's job is to offer emotional support. through things like rituals, empathy, prayer. But there can still be stigma in churches around clinical mental health care. NPR's Katie Riddle brings us this profile of one pastor in Harlem who is battling stigma within his congregation and leading by example. And a caution, this story discusses suicide.
Mental health was not something that Michael Walrond thought about much as a kid.
And I grew up in a traditional West Indian Caribbean household. It definitely wasn't talked about.
As an adult, he committed to a life of service and became a pastor. He got a Master's of Divinity degree, but he didn't get much explicit training around mental health. Then, in his late 30s, he found himself in a crisis.
I had an experience out of nowhere where I had a suicidal ideation.
Suicidal ideation is a kind of fantasy about dying by suicide. It can be an indicator of a serious illness.
I didn't realize I was dealing with depression and anxiety.
Research shows pastors have a disproportionate amount of these kinds of mental health issues. But Walrond says there's a stigma around talking about this occupational hazard. After his crisis, Walrond started going to therapy. He says it saved his life.
And I remember realizing that, you know what, if this has been such a critical impact on my life, I know other people may be suffering in silence.
His church is First Corinthian Baptist in Harlem. There are thousands of people in his congregation. It's a busy community hub all week, not just Sundays. On this morning, he stands outside a door upstairs. That is where his first part-time therapist worked years ago.
Yeah, she was here, and she was the first one when she said, Pastor, there's a lot of people who are coming.
At the time, he didn't know of any other churches that were hiring licensed clinicians. It's still rare. But he says once he started looking for it, he saw the need everywhere.
I think in African-American community, historically, there's been the normalization of trauma, right? So if you normalize trauma, then you don't really see the mental health impact of trauma.
Now the church has a separate nonprofit to provide therapy. It's around the corner. Throughout the office, staff play this music. It helps with confidentiality in their tight quarters. Lena Green is the executive director of this program.
So we currently have 7 clinicians on staff. We have 1, 2, 3. We have 3 doctors, 1 psychiatrist, 3 social workers, 1 psychologist.
It's funded through grants and church donations. Green says they're making progress, but stigma is something they're still battling. In recent years, Black teens and adolescents especially have seen an increase in mental health crises like suicide and suicide ideation.
Because for a lot of families, there's sort of what I like to call the conspiracy of silence, right? Like, we know this thing happened, but, you know, we shouldn't be talking about it publicly, but we know we need to get help.
Part of combating this stigma and encouraging people to use these services is bringing mental health struggles out into the open. This recording is from a church service a couple of years ago with Pastor Walrond.
I've known of moments when there were people who went to church, this is true, left church, and then experienced death by suicide.
People are swaying and crying, holding each other at this service. Walrond encourages congregation members to do something courageous, to stand up, to come to the front of the sanctuary if they could relate.
Those who are tired of life, and you're at that point where you're almost ready to give up today, I want you to come. I want you to make your way today.
Walrond says he looks to Scripture for guidance on this topic.
Elijah, who was a prophet, he asked God to take his life. It was Moses at a time who asked God to kill him. Like, you have several people in Scripture who wanted to die because of the weight of the responsibility and the expectations. No different.
He says physical needs are spiritual needs.
Part of the responsibility is to treat the needs of the people as holy.
Which means, says Pastor Michael Walrond, that mental health is holy. Katie Riddle, NPR News, Harlem.
And if you or someone you know is in crisis, you can call or text 988, just those 3 numbers, 988, for the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Sometimes there are second chances in literature. Charles Dickens Fagin, the central scoundrel in his 1838 novel Oliver Twist, leads a crime ring that exploits hungry orphans to rob unsuspecting Londoners. Fagin sings in Oliver, the musical inspired by Oliver Twist.
In this life, one thing counts. In the bank, large amounts. I'm afraid these don't grow on trees. You got to pick a pocket or two. You got to pick a pocket or two, boys.
You got to pick a pocket or two.
That's Ron Moody in the 1968 film. His portrayal in Dickens' own novel present Fagin as calculating, miserly, and cruel, depictions that have often been accused of being anti-Semitic. But what made Fagin who he was? Alison Epstein's new novel gives us Jacob Fagin from the age of 6, growing up in grimy London slums, what he does to get by and what he becomes. Her new novel, Fagin the Thief, and Alison Epstein joins us from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Why did you want to give this almost signature rapscallion a backstory?
Well, I'm glad we started with the clip of Ron Moody, actually. That was my introduction to the character of Fagin. And then as I got old enough to read the actual Oliver Twist, I very quickly realized this is a very different kind of character in the Dickens novel than in the musical. It's a two-dimensional stereotypical portrayal without question, but there's still something alive and interesting about him in a way that I just didn't want to let go of.
Yeah. Tell us about this small enclave of Stepney in London where he grew up.
That's one thing that Dickens really never talks about in Oliver Twist is where does Fagin come from? He just appears out of a cave in the eastern side of London, and I really had to think, you know, where would a person like that grow up? Where would a person like that come from? And as I was doing research, there were little enclaves of Jewish families that would settle in London as they would emigrate, and they kind of would stick together. And I was just really in love with that idea of a small culture kind of keeping its own sense of togetherness.
There's a very vivid scene in which young Jacob sees a man hanged for being a thief, and his mother wants him to see it. Why?
In the novel, she's pretty convinced that that's the road that he's on for his trajectory. In my novel, I imagine that Jacob Fagin's father was a thief as well, and he was hanged for thieving, which was, of course, very common at that time. And it seemed like it was a fate that was coming for my character of Fagin, sort of from the moment he was born. And his mother, of course, sees that coming and tries to stop it. But as you can imagine from where we know Fagin from, that's maybe not as successful as she had hoped.
And she dies when Jacob is young. What does that leave him? What are his options in life?
She is the most important person in his life, Jacob's mother. And once she passes away, he really is standing sort of on the precipice of the rest of his life. And there's no one next to him to help him decide where does he go next. So the most important thing for him becomes survival. What do I have to do today to make sure that I am alive to see tomorrow?
Let me ask you something you address in the afterword. Is Dickens' original portrayal of Fagin so grotesquely anti-Semitic that even Dickens regretted it?
He did, eventually. It took him some time. The novel was published originally in the 1830s, and it was, of course, serialized. As the novel wrapped up, he received a letter from a Jewish woman from London who was sort of taking him to task for his portrayal of Fagin. She commented that, you know, Dickens is such a wonderful hero and champion of the oppressed, but at the same time, he seems to have no particular sympathy for the character of Fagin. He refers to him almost exclusively as the Jew. And Dickens at first kind of pushed back against that feedback, but to give him credit, the next time he came about to write a Jewish character in one of his novels, it was a very different portrayal, let's say, than how he approached Fagin.
And I'm interested in, dare I call it, this dynamic. Fagin, Jacob Fagin, settles in an abandoned building that becomes his criminal headquarters, but also a kind of refuge for children like him, right?
Yeah, that was something that was important to me as I was working on a retelling of the original, to think about sort of in a different way, because of course, in Dickens's portrayal of Fagin, he's always kind of portrayed as a child snatcher and an opportunist who sees these small, vulnerable children and takes advantage of them. And there's certainly still some of that. I wouldn't call my Fagin an altruist in any particular way, but I did think, you know, there's a reason that someone would go into a life like that. And one thing that seemed clear to me was part of it is identification. That's a life that he had and is trying to help others from to not have.
There's a short line in the novel that, among many others, stays with me in particular. And it is said of Fagin, quote, I'm quoting you, of course, if he wants to eat today, he has work to do.
Yeah, there's no way around what has to happen. We can judge him and his court of thieves all we like for a life of lawlessness, but if they don't turn to that, what is the alternative? It doesn't seem possible to me that, you know, he would go out and get an ordinary job at a law firm and come back home at 5 p.m. to a nice yeah. home. That's not the path that he's on. That's not the opportunity he's being offered.
Reimagining and rewriting Dickens, what do you come to appreciate and maybe not like about his work?
I am repeatedly impressed by how strong Dickens is of a storyteller and how much of a picture he can paint of the world that his readers both knew and didn't know. In Oliver Twist in particular, there's a real bifurcation between the kind of polite world of society that Dickens does give, but then this underworld that his readers would have been completely unfamiliar with, and Dickens brings it to life so well. He is the absolute perfect source for someone writing historical fiction because he gives you everything you need to understand the time that he's living in. It's brilliant. As far as what I don't like about Dickens, it's a funny question because I think sometimes we have a tendency for writers like Dickens or, you know, like a Shakespeare, we'll take them and put them on such a pedestal in a canon that we'll think this author is a genius. And therefore, this author could not have written a book that could be any better. It's already perfect the way that it is. And I think the more time I spent with Dickens for this project, the more I was able to see him as a working writer who was trying to figure things out, who would make a plot decision in a novel that maybe didn't make any sense or maybe was not the route I would have chosen. There's things I disagree with in his writing, things I would do differently. That doesn't mean I write off Dickens as a fraud and an imposter, just that he's just out there making a living, doing an incredible job of it.
Yeah. Alison Epstein, her new novel, Fagin the Thief. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. This is NPR.